Welcome to another episode of Albert Camus Radio. In this episode, you'll be hearing an address I gave to the Albert Camus Society at the 2020 International Conference on Albert Camus. The Albert Camus Society hosts the annual Conference on Camus Studies, and it brings together the best and brightest minds studying Camus today. I hope you enjoy this short presentation, and there will be presentations by other scholars to follow in the next few weeks. Thank you and enjoy.
Thanks for the reminder, Peter. So Eric's going to talk now about, four character studies from the plague of the American cancer parks during COVID-19. So without further ado, Eric, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thanks to Peter for pulling this together. I know there's a lot of moving parts and it's done very quickly, and it's seamless, it's very smooth right now. Thanks, Simon, for chairing the session. So my presentation today is probably not going to turn into a publication. It was more of an exploring of the parallels between the two. I spent a fair amount of time in the plague, and it just seemed like there was some sort of responsibility to take a look at Camus' work on plague and our current situation in COVID-19. Being forced out of the formal academy by the closing of my college, I picked up this desire to do a little bit more public philosophy, and it's kind of a good thing. So here we go with a take a look at the plague and COVID-19. It's a really big subject matter, right? So I needed some way to cut it. So that's why I decided to select four characters and take a look at Camus' use of those characters and some connections in the unraveling of COVID-19 in the American landscape, and some lessons possibly learned between the two. And from that, I ended up with a little bit of Simone Weil thrown in with this idea of decreation, because Weil and Camus then together would take the high road in how to handle plague. And the American context has taken a different line than Weil and Camus would point us to through their work, which is sort of this idea of radical individualism. So I'll make just a quick run through of the two, and then we'll dive into the four characters, and I'll close with the Weil-Camus piece. Plague in the Oranian context then. Oran was actually hit by plague in the past in 1546, and in 1678, Oran was devastated by bubonic plague. So the city itself has a history that's pretty parallel to the rest of the Mediterranean or Europe with the rise of bubonic plague and the effect on the population. It had a very serious cholera epidemic in 1849, which hard to get accurate figures, but the French were in control then. So a large percentage of the population, upwards of 25%, were killed by a cholera epidemic in 1849. And this is a total little side note, but I did learn that Camus' nicknames for his children were plague and cholera. So you've got the two connected there. Plague struck Oran during the time when this novel is set and just previous to it. So in 1931, bubonic plague got established in Oran, but only 76 cases were confirmed. And in 1944 then, which makes the connection, because as we all know, the date is 1904 underscore in the text, there were 95 confirmed cases of bubonic plague in the city of Oran. You see the timeline there on my PowerPoint. April 16th, Rieu sees a dead rat. You've got a notation of 6,000 rats disposed of by the city by the 25th. The human case that presents itself to Rieu, at least in the Pierre-Noir population, is the 28th. The timeline gets a little slippery in the plague, which is completely intentional by Camus. It's the 31st, give or take a day, the word plague is uttered. The committee meets, so you get the official coming together of bureaucracy in Oran. on May 3rd and on May 13th, you get a death count of 40 humans that have died of this plague at this point. So they already have diagnosed it or called it plague, and then you have 40 deaths by the 13th. And then after that, Camus lets the human accounting of time slide and the natural accounting of time takes over. You get, it's very hard to track time after May 13th, May 15th in the text. It just becomes seasonal after that. In the American context then, 21st of January, the CDC confirms the first case here in the States. We get a federal health emergency declared on February 3rd. It's a national emergency on March 13th. And of course, all of us were aware of the global context at this point. These days are late. I think anybody's common sense would point you to a necessity to push this timeline back for public health. July 17th, the United States hits a wave of 77,638 infections. It's the highest single day rise of any cases in the world. And then I didn't want to try to pull the data this morning. So my data goes back to October 16th. We have 8 million COVID-19 cases in the United States on the 16th and 220,000 dead. Where I live in the central part of Illinois, the governor yesterday announced that restrictions are going to start to come back in because we're on the rise. Bars and restaurants in Chicago, et cetera, are going to start to have to shut down and limit patrons again. Camus' plague then, what physically is going on here? It's bubonic plague. It's the Black Death that he introduces in his novel to Oran. It's spread by flea bites, as we all know. They start on rats and move to dogs and cats probably, and then jump to human prey after that. The symptoms of a flea bite from an infected flea is 1 to 2 days symptoms start to appear by the victims, and death takes about 10 days if it's gonna take hold of you and take your life. In 1940, the death rate, now this is given Camus' methods used in Oran, and there's wonderful medical literature that say it was mishandled by 1940 standards in Oran, but Camus is not a medical doctor, nor is he writing the text for that particular point. So it's mishandled, but hey, that makes my presentation all the better because the case is going to be clear. It's been mishandled here in the United States also. So in 1940, given what Camus tells us, and he gives us a decent amount of information about the medical side of it, the death rate would have been about 60% of the inhabitants in Oran. Of course, that's the Pir Noir residents and also the Arab population in Oran that has been ignored in the text. The plague switches, which is part of the pathogen, part of the life cycle of plague. It will switch and mutate to pneumonic plague, typically. So he has that right, according to medical experts. And the mortality rate, given the stops and the effects that Camus introduces in the novel, would have been about a 90% death rate when we switch to the pneumonic form of the plague towards the end, which is pulmonary. It gets in the lungs. COVID-19 in the United States, the symptoms appear in 2 to 14 days after exposure to the virus. So it makes it a little bit more deadly on that behalf because there's not immediate symptoms and the virus sheds before symptoms come in. With plague, it's quicker, which is helpful in terms of fighting off the disease from a societal aspect. Mortality rate is something that's widely debated and shouldn't be. Yeah, hard to get accurate data on. It's about 2.7%. These are CDC and WHO figures that I'm using here. So the mortality rate is about 2.7% in the United States. And infection rates are not calculated in the same way. So the infection rate by way of respiratory droplets in the US then is a transmission rate of about 1.16 as of October, which means every infected person spreads it to 1.16 other people. That's the transmission rate that the United States is dealing with COVID-19. The character studies that I'm going to be doing here in the plague is Father Panlow, Dr. Ryu, Cotterd, and Rambert. Those are the only four. I needed some way to contain this talk to half an hour, and I isolated it to those four. If we want to discuss other parallels that you're seeing or have seen in the plague, that's kind of hopefully some of the discussion that'll grow from this. Father Panlow then is described as a Jesuit priest. Orthodox is one of the ways that that is translated, which means very much in tune with Jesuit theology, but more importantly, he's a scholar of Augustine. So he's very much thinking like Augustine, which is, this is a great choice for Camus for a number of reasons, because Father Panlow obviously reflects the French Catholic Church position during World War II. And he's not strawmanning the Catholic faith here in any way. He's taking Jesuits have a very fine reputation and well-deserved reputation for academic excellence. And he's going to use Augustine, who's a solid theologian, and that's an underselling of Augustine. And plus Camus knows Augustine, so it's nice that way. Father Panlow is a preacher and a theologian. His ability to deliver these two sermons are very well done. And of course, his theological background is extremely solid. He's probably taken from Bossuet. You see the dates there, and that's a painting of Bossuet in my PowerPoint, is probably the character that Camus used to get a general sketch of who Father Panlow will be. One of my favorite characters in the plague, because he dies a questionable case. I think it's a masterpiece of Camus' writing. It's a double play of words there, right, or the phrase. He dies a questionable case. He's probably got pneumonic plague at this point, but we're not exactly sure that he died of plague. But more importantly, he dies a questionable case in his theological disposition, because his last sermon or his book or his pericope that he was writing there at the end was clearly outside the realm of Catholic thought. And he dies a questionable case in terms of his situation theologically. Sermon one is dead on Augustine's response to this. Plague visits us because of our sinful ways. This is God's hand in the world to form some sort of corrective behavior on us. The death of the child, the suffering of the child, you can't use that position anymore. It's theologically untenable. So he switches to another early church, African church father, Tertullian, I believe, because it is absurd. So in the face of this, one must hold faith. So the two sermons are stunning, certainly, in the text. So two American religious responses to COVID, Baptists and Lutherans are the two that I'm sort of looking at here. The French response by Panlow mirrors the French Catholic position officially after the occupation and the concession to Nazi Germany. We're paying for our sins in this, by this occupation by a foreign force. And then once the French and the Allied forces start to get some muscle against the fascists and against the Nazis, they switch to a more Tertullian position, which we believe in God, despite the absurdity of the world that we live in with the knowledge of concentration camps, etc. White evangelical Christians follow this Augustinian line absolutely right down the line, but I'm quite sure that very few have read Augustine or studied Augustine, but they've fallen into this line of thinking that it is because of the sinful ways of the United States that we're being punished by COVID-19. It is a plague that has been delivered upon the U.S. About 25% of the population identifies as evangelical Christians. If you add on maybe 20% of the population is Roman Catholic that would follow this Augustinian line, you get about 45% of the Christian population in the United States that would feel this way about COVID-19, that God has delivered this to the American landscape to correct behavior. The Lutheran response, which I'm very familiar with, the bishop came out immediately with a response, and the response was service to the neighbor. That's the primary goal here, is service to the neighbor. We shut down public worship and move forward with what we can do with flattening out the curve and helping those people that have lost their job and et cetera, those people that are in need. So you're going to see that this Lutheran response lines up much more closely with the lesson that Camus is trying to teach in the plague to how to respond to this. But problem is, only about 6% of the American population is Lutheran. Episcopals tend to believe the same way. So you add another 4%, you've got about 10% of the American population that took this secondary approach to plague, 10% of the American Christian population. Dr. Ryu then is our next person we're going to look at. Of course, we all know he's the actual narrator of the text. He's a gentleman in his mid-30s. There's some physical resemblance to Camus. I've had wonderful discussions with lots of you about the slices of Camus that end up in each one of these characters. Possibly modeled after Montelat. And as you see a photograph there, it's a possible modeling of who Dr. Ryu is in the text. And we get a real study in contrast here then between the situation in Oran from the medical community and the situation in the United States from the medical community. Oran is isolated. They quarantine, and the communication to Paris and other points beyond, even Algiers, is very, very limited. So the resources that are available inside Oran are the resources that you're going to have to work with. Now, clearly, this is a literary device too, right? This is Camus, the theater, where you set the stage and you limit those outside forces so you can control what's going on inside and you can control the actors inside this theater that he set up. But it does make a nice parallel to learn a larger lesson about how one should handle plague on a political level. The United States was certainly connected. We were very, very deeply invested in the World Health Organization, and we were very deeply invested in flattening the earth, becoming a global community. But the American position moved very, very quickly to isolation. This was going to be handled inside the United States. The foreign policy was going to be directed about what's best for the United States. So the United States starts out with a global position and then very quickly moves to an isolation position, which parallels the situation in Oran perfectly. Vaccine, there's a high level of trust, and not a lot in the text about it, but there certainly is a high level of trust in a serum that will come from Paris or can be developed locally that will stop plague from spreading throughout Oran. And the American response is profit, a nationalistic response to a serum or a vaccine, to use a better term. It becomes a competition. It becomes an American badge of pride that must be worn that we develop the vaccine for our people first, so we distribute to our people first, and then we sell it at a profit, probably internally too, but certainly sell it at a profit externally. So that's the attitude that's taken towards a vaccine. And then the attitude shifts. You get a lack of trust by 40-45% of the population because of the handling of the regulations on the vaccine, the push through the FDA, and the distrust of the executive branch of the government in the United States, that even well-educated people on the left side of the political spectrum in the United States show a high level of distrust for early rounds of vaccine. There's a high level of trust in public health systems in Oran. That's where it's going to be handled. The population trusts that group in the United States. That the seeds of distrust were sown very, very quickly with the Centers for Disease Control. In 2018, I think if most people would ask, their level of trust with the CDC would be extraordinarily high. Now you've got about 42-43% of the American population that will not listen to the CDC. They have almost no trust in that particular entity. The data is not trusted in the United States. You have an idea of solidarity in Oran, where you're working together as a population to solve this, and the rise of individualism is what is seen in the United States. It is an individual matter in the US and not in Oran. Oran, it seems to be data-driven by the medical professionals that are laid out in the text, and you end up with many false narratives about the public health system in the US. Cotard, one of my favorite characters, again, in the plague. Cotard is a criminal, as we know. He's under indictment. when the text opens, there's an attempted suicide because of this pressure of the criminal system that's sort of crushing in on Cotard. But then plague comes, and the resources of the government have to be directed elsewhere. They're not directed at criminal activity anymore. For the most part, they're directed at saving lives in the public health sector. Cotard then has a huge epiphany. He changes during this period of time because the pressure's off him. And then the pressure comes back as plague subsides and the criminal justice system gets back to their regular business. And of course, he ends up in a gunfight, ridiculous gunfight at the end. And there's a very strong Kierkegaard connection to the character formulation of Cotard. Cotard, I see as a parallel to the rise of American fascism here. There's this freedom to be with no Leviathan, right? So I'm mixing a couple terms here, but I think we all understand what happens here. With Cotard, he's under indictment. He's under constraint when the novel opens. The criminal justice system is taking its turn with him, and these wheels are relentlessly grinding against him. And the outcome is going to be one of several ways, but it's out of his control. American fascists prior to 2017, 18 were under constraint. We didn't do that here. We didn't allow that voice. The press didn't allow it. The common sense didn't allow that fascist element to be present. Very million libertarian views in the United States of wanting that conversation in the public sphere. But the reason that we let fascists in the public sphere in the US is to constantly remind ourselves how poor their thinking is, why we don't want to do that. When freedom from indictment comes with Cotard, this is lifted from him. And he's a very, very different person when the constraints are taken off. The same thing happens in the United States with the radical right wing or the fascist wing in the United States. The president of the United States gives those people a voice, a platform, and freedom. Those constraints of political and social pressure to not be that way, to not think that way, because it's wrong, not just force it, but understand why it's wrong to be racist and sexist and a bigot and an Islamophobe. Those chains are lifted off that group and they get the same openness. There's this lightness that Cotard feels when the criminal justice system is taken away from him. The same sort of elevation of a fascist platform happens in the United States. When the Leviathan comes back over Cotard, he's crushed because the wheels of justice pick up where they take off and they're just going to march forward. And he wants it done. So he gets in this ridiculous gunfight and lashes out because he's back under those constraints. I fear what will happen in the American context when the Leviathan comes back and puts a stop to the levitation that the American right wing has felt. So that part of the Cotard dialogue is yet to play itself out. Maybe we'll go down the road of fascism. I certainly hope not. But if we go back to what we were in 2016, 15, there will be a constraint placed on fascism. And I hope they don't go the route of Cotard and strike out in some ridiculous, violent fashion. Rambert, striking similarities to Camus in the text, right? Again, he's locked down and away from his love. The most parts of the plague were written when the two, Francine and Camus, are separated between Oran and Free France. He's a young journalist, Rambert is. He's on a very similar assignment that Camus was on in the 1930s. And of course, he's an ex-football player, to use the continental version of that. So there's a divergence here. You get Rambert as being this objective voice of the text, and he's an outsider, so he's come in to observe this and is very objective in his ability to report what's going on in Oran because he doesn't know anybody and he's not tied into the deep subcultures that are in Oran. He's free from that. there are false accounts, there are false remedies printed in the newspaper, but for the most part, you get Rambert as this objective force to be able to observe what goes on. The American press, we get this erosion of credibility, this American epistemology that exists now, you get an infinite regress of skepticism. Any report that comes out in the press that somebody doesn't like, they question the data, which is good. We should do that, right? But at a certain point, you've got to trust the data. So if the data came from the CDC, well, the CDC is fabricating it because they have an ulterior motive. And it's in a way to erode any sort of credibility. It becomes a citizen-selected narrative in the U.S. where there's this echo chamber. You have a desired outcome, and you find a news report that lines up with that, and you reject all others. This idea of fake news that was purported early in the Trump administration, I think, is far more damaging than we thought. I think it has made a deep impact on the everyday citizen in the U.S. and their idea of epistemology, or what counts for truth, how we verify truth. Bonus round, a couple quick bonus rounds here. Dr. Cassell, first to sound the alarm, first to officially call it in plague. I think he's Fauci. He plays a very small role in the novel because of the French epistemology. Yeah, if the doctors say it's plague, it's plague. Fauci plays a large role in the American landscape because you have an expert, the expert, and he's called into question by people that get their information from YouTube, and they have a platform. So the parallels between the high visibility of Fauci and the low visibility of Cassell is very, very interesting in the text. And I had to find Trump. It was hard, right? I had to find him here, though. I think he's the actor in Orpheus, the play that takes place inside the play. So Camus, they go see the play, and the lead character is struck by a plague or has plague, and it strikes him to the point where he can't continue acting. It's a very surreal moment. Obviously, the plague is a novel, but it's also very much a play. And inside the play, there's a play going on, and it's play acting. You get this surreal, this relief, or this notion of things not being real, and this idea of Trump acting the way that he does and actually claiming to have COVID, be it true or not, really, I think, draws a strong parallel in my mind to the actor in Orpheus, but I had to put him in there. Lessons learned and not learned. The sanitation squads in Oran, you get this solidarity that's very, very important. And you get up to 40% of the U.S. population that doesn't want to wear masks to do this. And you have people in Iran that are handling plague-infested bodies for the common good. And you get people in the United States that won't go to the grocery store with a mask on because it violates their notion of freedom. We don't have a central mandate for the government or central organization. Iran had that, and they defeated plague in a much better way than we are. There's an anti-science, anti-intellectualism, radical relativism epistemology that's growing in the United States. This Ubermensch mentality of the president during and after the personal contraction of COVID is certainly disturbing. The early heroes in the American landscape were healthcare workers. It's tragic to me that they've later been demonized for the false narrative that they're fraudulently reporting COVID deaths for financial gain for hospitals. And grocery store workers are held up as early heroes because people needed food and toilet paper and those things needed to be stocked. Truck drivers and the like were held up as early heroes, which parallels nicely with the plague. One of the groups of people that Camus wants to shine a light on in the plague clearly are these everyday workers that allow life to go on at a subsistence level in Oran. And in our landscape in the United States, we did reflect that. Lesson from Simone Weil. And an opposite reaction, one of these really nice pieces that Bay has is her idea of decreation, or undoing yourself to make room for others. That's this idea of solidarity, this idea of I can remove my self-interest and my center on myself and make room for others' needs. You see the opposite reaction in the American context. You get this radical American individualism. I might call it hyper-creation when we're talking in the context of Weil's decreation, where you make room for yourself only. It's my rights, my decision if I'll wear a mask, my decision if I'll do this, that, and the other. I'm going to exercise the power in this situation and not allow room for others in this world. Decreation and solidarity here. So we get a really nice connection with Ve and Camus again, because I think the central point in this lane that I'm driving in on the plague about how one lessons one can learn in a pandemic is the idea of solidarity is where Camus is shining the moral light or the political light primarily here. And that really lines up nicely with Ve's idea of decreation, emptying oneself and making room for others in that particular situation. I welcome question and thank you.
Good job, Eric.
Broken everything. Right, I've managed to unmute myself. So I think some claps came through. So let's just have another quick clap for Eric on that. Brilliant talk. I mean, and we have some comments in the chat that people say. Something I have to say from the outset is that Eric chose to have a picture of Cillian Murphy from Peaky Blinders as Cotard, whereas Cotard is far more like sort of Edward G. Robinson, a little short, squat guy, I think. So apologies for Eric's bad choice of photograph there. Right. There's lots of various comments flying around. We've got about 15 minutes to have a little chat about Eric's paper, then we're going to move on to Peter's paper, and then we're going to have a big panel discussion.
We have a very exciting announcement. All episodes of Albert Camus Radio will now be sponsored by Vectus Consulting. Vectus Consulting specializes in consulting humanities departments, so they're a very good fit for Albert Camus Radio. Vectus Consulting specializes in growing humanities departments, retaining current students enrolled in your humanities department, and raising the visibility of your humanities department. We are very happy to have Vectus Consulting as a supporter. They can be found at vectusconsulting.org. Vectusconsulting.org.